Session number 10420, Rule 47.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 47. You're leaving Cabrit, Colonel, and going on leave.
Four days, I think it was, in Cairo. But I left all my company commanders with the first Dorsets to continue their help in the training of that particular battalion. Now, while I was in Cairo, I went to see a light-hearted entertainment given by the Polish army, called Polish Parade. It really was an extraordinary well done. And they had an orchestra and dancers and that sort of thing. And the dancers were quite superb. They were Polish acts who'd all been on the stage at Krakow or somewhere like that. But the orchestra, I always remember, played the Lambeth Walk, as Strauss would have done it, as Chopin would have done it, and as Toscanini would have done it, and then as the conductor himself would have done it, and then as Hitler would have done it. And the conductor, when he turned round after he'd done it like Hitler, was Hitler himself. And it brought the house down in the theatre in Cairo. I always remember Polish Parade. They were frightfully good. And then I went out after my leave was over to Mina House, the camp at Mina, which is just outside Cairo, adjoining the pyramids. And there I remember having a dinner party with Jerry Mansell, my old intelligence officer. He was one of them, and it was really a sort of glamorous in the moonlight of Mina House Hotel and the pyramids and all the rest, really a sort of Middle East. And I got the whole of the brigade transport there, and I had to take it from there to Cabrit. So I got it all smartened up, and this huge column, and I had vast number of motorcyclists in the brigade, of course, accompanying me, as if I was a very distinguished person, and we drove right through Cairo, this great long column of MT, and two people I waved to me. One was, in fact, the corps commander, Oliver Lees, and the other one was Sim Feversham, Lord Feversham, who had been on the course with me at Helwan, and I'd seen him from time to time when I'd been on leave in Cairo. He was now commanding the Yorkshire Hussars, and he passed me and waved to me. Anyhow, we eventually got down to Cabrit, and the battalion started its seaborne training. I remember the first day when they were completely at sea when they went down onto the Hard and saw all these landing craft all drawn up. And of course they had to learn first how to get into them, how to sit in them before ever taking to the water. And the chief instructor was a chap called Board, Captain Board, and I remember he had an uncle who I knew was a land agent at Pateley Bridge. And we were warned that we would have to give a demonstration, of one company demonstration, to everybody else. And so we just did seaborne training. The adjutant did worked out loading tables. But you have to be really careful of what you can get aboard a landing craft, loading tables, and we did these rehearsals. And on the 1st of June, the glorious 1st of June, Spike Galloway's company gave a landing demonstration in front of the Corps commander and the GOCs of the 5th and the 50th Division. And I had to describe it all over a loudspeaker, and everybody else was there watching. Now, from the Army point of view, it went very well. But Board, from the Navy point of view, was very disgruntled with the whole of his crews. To start with, a kedge anchor, I remember, fouled a propeller. They went in, the crafts went in too fast. Now, when the bow of the landing craft assault is down, that's the signal that the soldiers must get out. And they start to run out. Well, then once they're in the water, it slows them up tremendously. They can only just plow wade through the water. Well, if this, the craft has a certain amount of weigh on it, it catches the soldier behind the knees and drowns him, knocks him over and drowns him. And this is what nearly happened on this demonstration. This, from the soldier's point of view, it was splendid, but from the naval point of view, it wasn't quite so good. And Board was not at all satisfied with his sailors.
What was the trick to stop this way, this pushing forward by the boat after the soldiers had got in? Was there some kind of timing when they had to let that...
What should happen is the bow go down and hit the ground under the sea. But once it starts to go down, the chaps can run out as it's going down. And to get quickly ashore, but he catches them if they're not careful behind the knee and knocks them over, and then the whole craft goes right over the top of the chap in the water before bow hits this sand.
How many men could get into
33? I think I'm right in saying was the number you could get in. I think it was about 33. And then, too, there was an awful... You were supposed to be able to fire your 2-inch mortars as you were coming in. Well, if bullets were flying and shells were flying and waves were tossing the landing craft, to fire the 2-inch mortars was well nigh impossibility. And that didn't go down too well. Anyhow, it was the glorious 1st of June. And I remember that night I went down and had dinner with Captain Board and others in Suez, and he produced lobster and champagne, and we drank to the glorious 1st of June. Now, the next day, a warning order came that we'd completed the training. And we were to move the 30 miles from Cabrit down the canal to Suez and to the camp in Attica. A march, we were told, would take, would be the whole way. We had to march the whole way down to Attica. Well, this was the most appalling bombshell, to march 30 miles in the sweating heat of midsummer down to Attica really wasn't on, and it really was a fearful bombshell. And on the 5th of June we actually moved, but the glorious Royal Navy came to our rescue, and they took us in landing crafts. God knows what would have happened if we'd had to march 30 miles in mid-June down the Pauling Road through Suez and down to Attica. Attica is down the Gulf of Suez, and it was a camp appallingly sandy and dirty and dusty at the base of the Jebel Attica, and there we were to be housed for some time to come, nearly a month. And what we used to do was we used to have a reveille at something like 3:45 in the morning, and we would then leave the camp about 4:15, and we would climb the Jebel Attica to keep fit. And it was beautifully cool on the top in the early hours of the morning. But I do remember the first morning we went up, about halfway up. It was a roughish climb, mind. But I think a fellow in the 9th Battalion fell down some of the cliffs and was killed. You had to go carefully in the dark. Anyhow, our first morning, we got halfway up the Jebel Attica when, from a house on the hillside, an Egyptian came out and said, "Good lemonade, good lemonade. 4 piastres a bottle, good lemonade." And he tried to sell us lemonade and to relieve of the thirst as we climbed up the top. But it really was rather a pleasant operation to do when the rest of the day was scorchingly hot and very sandy and dusty. It really was a dreadful camp. We were confined to the camp. We weren't allowed to leave. It was...
Was it a tented camp?
No. Well, I suppose with bivvies, I think. The men all ate on the desert floor in what we call sheep pens. They were, in fact, literally sheep pens with canvas sides all the way round to keep the dust out.
What was food like?
Well,
what was the food like?
Oh, the food wasn't bad, of course, but... it was just the ordinary food. Well, then we had to learn how to be carried in our assault ships, and we had to embark, which we did about the 9th of June or about somewhere around about there, in the vast fleet that was lying off Suez. And we, the exercise which we were going to do was called Broomyard, and we embarked on the Winchester Castle, His Majesty's troop ship, the Winchester Castle, which was of the Castle Line, and we embarked. And what we had to do when we embarked was to learn how to move about the ship, find our way about in daylight to start with. But then we had to learn to do it in pitch darkness, find your way about the ship in pitch darkness. And took some considerable time. We also had to learn where our boat stations were. There were no lifeboats alongside. They were all landing craft alongside. And this was all done in the sweltering heat. And then we sailed down the Gulf of Suez into the Red Sea, and then up the Gulf of Aqaba to carry out an invasion rehearsal. we arrived at Aqaba, I suppose, about the 11th of June, and we carried out a signal exercise. And then on the 13th of June, I think it was, we did in fact carry out a landing exercise at 12:15 a.m. in the morning. And there was some Indian troops were the opposition. I think they were the Rajputanas or something like that. And they were pretty savage opposition. And I had one or two chaps wounded, and I had one chap lost an eye in the landing. I know the CO was frightfully apologetic afterwards, and he said how sorry he was that things should have got to such a...
Was this through firing of weapons or hand-to-hand conflict?
Firing of blank, of course. But blank is dangerous if it's fired too close to you. And obviously, my chap who lost an eye had a blank fired at him far too close. I think they had used knives or bayonets or something like that. But it was just part and parcel of the training. Anyhow, when I landed, it was dark, of course, in the morning. When I landed, I was met by my cousin, Mark Chapman Walker, who was Jumbo Wilson's PA, and he said, come along, the Commander-in-Chief is here, wants to see you. And there, sitting rather like a bullfrog in the half-light, was the great man himself on the top of a little mound, and I had to explain to him what it was all about. But the whole attack and was over by 8:30, and we then climbed up the hill on the Sinai side, I remember, of the Gulf of Aqaba, to a temporary camp there for the night. And we were told that it was unsafe to bathe on account of sharks and other dangerous fish. So nobody was allowed to bathe, but it really was appallingly hot, quite unbelievable down there. And it was too hot really to get any sleep. You just lay there and slept out in the open for that night. And then we embarked again the next day. What was rather interesting that night was the whole of the fleet. Of course, it was a vast fleet. There were Orontes and Winchester Castle, and I don't know what else there were. The 9th Battalion were on the Orontes. The whole of the fleet hid itself in a cloud of smoke, and all you could see was the masts, few masts sticking out in this vast smoke screen which filled the whole Gulf of Aqaba. Now, on this, the side we were on was the Sinai side, which was Egypt. Aqaba itself, it was Palestine, and on the coming round the bend, you might say, was Saudi Arabia. And no account were we to go into get into Saudi Arabia, but we could go anywhere else, of course. But one didn't; one just stayed put. And we went. We embarked again on the 14th, and we then disembarked later on in the day, and we went and listened to a light-hearted talk by Admiral Troubridge against, as opposed to General Dempsey, the Corps commander. And it was a very good talk indeed, which we listened to in Aqaba itself, and then returned to our ships. And we then started to our return journey. Now,
what was the subject of the Admiral's talk?
Well, with cooperation between the Navy and the Army, and how the exercise had gone, what he thought of it from the naval side, and Dempsey would say what he thought of it from the Army side. You had to have this cooperation, otherwise the whole thing would fail. And but they were both jolly good, rather amusing senior officers, you might say, and there was banter between the two of them. We returned back to the ship, and then we set sail for Attica again, our camp, and we disembarked in due course and went into the camp. The purser of the Winchester Castle and the OC troops both congratulated me, I remember, on the fact that we left behind on board a little rail party to clean up, and that we were the first troops ever to leave a rail party to clean up, and they congratulated the battalion as they were frightfully taken by the fact that we wanted to leave a clean ship. While we are talking about the crew, it always slightly annoyed me on this operation that the stewards wanted tips on board. They expected a tip. They expected a tip now on this occasion to be tipped. And they expected a tip before we went into Sicily. In fact, I believe they'd had trouble on the Orontes with the 9th Battalion, who'd rather jibbed at giving them tips. But of course, the stewards I know were getting more pay than one of my second lieutenants or one of my lieutenants. They were getting overtime, pay, overtime, and danger money. And it always rankled me that these chaps should get more than my junior officers. And perhaps that's why we're suffering now strikes in Dover and another port, because they expected too much. But we did. I'm almost sure we handed the cap round forward to it on both occasions. Anyhow, we went back to our camp at Attica, and we again climbed the Jebel, and we did training with a weapon called the Piat. The Piat had just been issued to us. We were issued with all the up to the latest equipment you could possibly think of, and the Piat was one, and we did a lot of training with the Piat, and were visited by Monte, who gave us one of his usual talks, but it wasn't as good. It was very good, but it wasn't as good as what I'd heard before the Battle of Alamein. And we were visited by Sir James Grigg, who was the Minister of War. He came to see us and spent 10 minutes with us. He was a dour chap, and he saw us all eating on the desert floor in our sheep pens. But he seemed to be completely out of his depth. Nevertheless, he paid us a visit. And it was there, too, that I got rid of harrowing. I got a chap called Teddy Worrell, who'd been Andrew Clark's second in command, or had he been a company commander in the 9th Battalion. I wasn't really satisfied with him in the end. He was wounded in Sicily, and he was rather disagreeable after the war in peacetime. And we continued our dry shot training. And a few days about that time, I was told where we were going to land. Nobody else knew in the battalion, but I was, COs were told that we were going to land in Sicily. Now, on the 29th of June, we embarked in the Z-lighters, what they call Z-lighters, that took us out to the Winchester Castle, and we embarked, and everybody was guessing the destination. And when we did embark, there were all our Royal Naval old faces, the crews that we'd got used to and known so well with our training in Cabrit. There was a great liaison by now between the between us and the Royal Navy. Now, when they incidentally brought us all the way down from Cabrit to Suez on the 30-mile, saved us the 30-mile march, they sent a signal to the officer commanding, which was me, the troops in the landing craft, best of luck from Cabrit or something like that. A signal came to you while you were aboard. And there was that sort of great liaison by now between the Royal Navy and ourselves. And we, as I say, we embarked on again on the Winchester Castle. We had, I should perhaps mention here, we'd only had two brigades in the division, the 69th and 151. You see, we'd lost the 150 in the Gazala line. So now we were given a new brigade, the 168th Brigade, and it comprised the London Scottish, London Irish, and 10th Royal Barks. And I can remember a few days before we embarked, we were all invited to go and have drinks with this brigade, new brigade, which we all did, all went and had drinks there. And the General Kirkman, who was our GOC now in the place of Crasher, he'd sent a message to them that said, would they please ensure that the pipes were kept away, the pipers were kept well away from the officers' mess. And he wasn't having the Irish pipers and the Scottish pipers making a noise outside the mess. Anyhow, that's just beside the point. We embarked on the 29th, and our chief naval officer was a chap called Captain Smith. He was called the Snoll,